Welcome back. What a pleasure it is to be with Annette Gordon-Reed, Bill Russell, and I, Paula. And yet it really isn't Jefferson per se on whom we focus. It is Jefferson within the context of family.
Yes, exactly.
And that is a radically different way, for me anyway, to think of Jefferson, because his family was quite different from my cartoon book history. Oh yeah, well there were, but the experience of family is something everybody can relate to, whatever our families may have been, and it wasn't the way that most of us think about it, or you wouldn't have written 600 pages about it, with wonderful footnotes, by the way.
Oh, thank you
for the footnotes.
Thank you. I love footnotes. That's what I sort of read footnotes sometimes before I read text, but of books. No, it was not a family in the way that it's typically portrayed in books that are basically trying to give people a sort of snapshot view of what his life was like. It was terribly complicated. And I think it's interesting to think about, we can relate to family, but it's interesting to think about 18th century families and the role of women. Certainly this overlay of slavery, a slave society where people are interacting, not just like, you know, employer, employee, but people who are in your family home, around you all the time. People of different races, which we live sort of separate lives in America today, blacks and whites. But ironically, I mean, blacks and whites lived more closely together in slavery than any other time. So there are all these kinds of complications that come to the fore when you live with people.
Well, and they are, the richness of what you have done is truly compelling.
Thank you.
I think the fascination, you talk about humans like stories, the fascination of, well, let's see, that would be his mother. No, it's not his mother-in-law. And yet what we have gotten until very recently is the very specific white family, which you credit with a lot of the reason we don't know about the family that had come out of Africa, because it got scrubbed between then and now. How much of a barrier was that? Did they do as good a job as it appears?
Well, they did a good job for a long time. I mean, for 150 years, there was sort of a set narrative of Jefferson's life. And the story of the Hemings family, one aspect of the story of the Hemings family, namely Sally Hemings, was really obscured by Jefferson's grandchildren,
The
white grandchildren, who out of their love for their grandfather. And this is what families do. I mean, it's not families. The good part about family is we stick together. The bad part about family is we stick together. Even when there are times when the truth, and we keep thinking of the truth as being as important, and it is, but it was a protective measure, because they understood how he would be viewed if people accepted this story. Think of it now, the sort of sense that, well, if this is true, then I can't respect Jefferson. He has to be taken off a pedestal and so forth. Imagine in the 1820s or 1830s if people had accepted this story. And so it was out of protectiveness and love for him that they really obscured a lot of things.
And yet you can put him back. I could put him back on the pedestal.
Well,
or at least a couple of steps toward
part
the
of this.
Pedestal.
I mean, what's
not,
so valuable?
Not smashing it, you know. Not smashing it.
What's
them,
so valuable about this is none of these people should be on pedestals. They were walk around human beings. Mm-hmm. They were not gods incarnate. They were people with foibles and problems and challenges and character defects. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that to me was part of what's so important about what you've done is to make these people human beings. Mm-hmm. And the contradictions that go with that.
And also, to me, they are, not that anybody, not that you could make anybody gods, just as you said, these people are more than human beings. It makes their accomplishments that much more interesting to me to know that someone could come out of the sort of normal human maelstrom that we're all in and then have the presence of mind, have the fortitude to actually, you know, help found a country, to help, you know, be a president, to do all those kinds of things. So it doesn't diminish him in my eyes in any way. I mean, to the extent that he's diminished, it's about the slaveholding in general. That's the problem. But so it's not the kinds of the human things that go on in that institution. You expect this stuff to happen. The bigger notion is the issue of slaveholding. This was a part of his time and so forth. But this is No, to make them human and to see humans achieve, to me, is always, I'm fascinated by people who can do that.
One of the, I think in that context, one of the things that jumped out at me is something I'd simply never thought about, and it probably has not been written about, you being a lawyer. One of his challenges, you know, it wasn't just that it was socially inappropriate. It was all, you know, a lot of what he was doing, both in this country and in France, was illegal. Mm-hmm. This from the guy who believed in the rule of law. Mm-hmm. And the contradiction in that, and it's the way it would reflect on his fundamental values, is articulated in lots of different places. Mm-hmm. Would have been, to say the least, awkward, mm-hmm. Both in his time, but he was also concerned about posterity.
Yeah, yeah. But he keeps clearly, because he wrote some of the most, you know, trenchant statements against slavery. I mean, he knew what society's judgment was going to be of that institution. He clearly saw it as a retrogressive system, that this was something in the past. And yet, here's a guy who wanted more than anything to be thought of as a progressive. He was a liberal. I mean, that would be that phrase today that we don't like to use. But he would
I like to use
okay,
it.
Okay.
Say liberal. It's a
okay,
good word.
Right.
It's reclaimable.
It's reclaimable. So he would be a liberal / progressive. He would be a person who's always on the lookout for what is new, always believing that the world is going to be better, that you can improve the lot of mankind. And so, yeah, that would be, for him, it's a really, really interesting position to be in, that you are born into this society and you recognize the problems with it, and you want to be a great man, you want to be thought of, well thought of. So that's what his writings are about. But he, like many of us in other areas, could not sort of live up to, sort of emotionally, you know, sort of live up to what his intellectual beliefs were. And that's the real, that's what makes him interesting, because he's sort of a mirror to us in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
And that's why I think people are fascinated with him.
This Sally Hemings in this context is a relatively new phenomenon, because for a long time we wouldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. The denial and the record had been purged as best they could manage. And in some ways it's almost a good thing, because it gives us a basis to now have discussions that we just haven't been willing to have for a long time. Long time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. About race in this country, mm-hmm. About not only about slavery, but the relationship between men and women, as well as between races. This is not just about about race. The female role is very important in this,
yeah,
too.
I just found myself learning and learning and learning, and yes, I know how it's going to come out. Eventually, we all die.
Yeah, right.
They'll tell me that.
In the long run, we'll all be dead. What the economists say,
right.
In the long,
that's right,
run, we'll all be dead.
But there were just big holes in my thinking about this, and most particularly that Sally Hemings had options. Mm-hmm. Who knew that, mm-hmm, Sally Hemings, mm-hmm, had options? Even if you knew about Sally, mm-hmm, the whole flow of her life and the places she went, how come Sally had options living in that time and place?
Well, you know, she had options because for a time she wasn't in America. I mean, she was not in Virginia. And that's the thing that people don't tend to focus on, that she and her brother James were living in France for a number of years, where slavery, I mean, they didn't want slavery on French soil. They didn't mind it in their colonies, but they didn't want it on French.
Like, they were very enthusiastic.
Well, it made them a lot of money.
Right.
It made them a boatload of money. Martinique and Guadeloupe and Saint-Domingue, I mean, just bundles of money. But they didn't want it on French soil.
And this was just before the Revolution.
Just before the Revolution, the late 1780s. The French Revolution, their revolution. And hundreds of enslaved people file freedom petitions, and every single one was granted. It was pretty much a pro forma thing, and it got to a point where masters, people who had come from the colonies and brought their slaves with them, started just freeing them, because one of the features, some evidence that I had of it, is that, you know, they had what was called fee shifting. The person who lost the case had to pay, and masters began to realize, wait a minute, if we're going to go to court and I'm going to lose and I'm going to have to pay costs, the better thing to do is to just free them. So she was in a place where she and her brother could have taken their freedom. And we tend to think about them as being in Virginia. It's like, you know, they're slaves, they're born in Virginia. No matter where you take them, Virginia law applies. But that's not true. Jurisdiction, the law speaking, The law does not speak in one jurisdiction all over the world. So she did have that option. Once she comes back to the United States, she's under Jefferson's power because she's back again under Virginia law. But for those years in Paris, there could have been a different outcome.
And it's that to me just exploded on my own horizon, because suddenly, as Bill was saying, you have gender issues. That's not trivial for a female. The whole gender layer of this, a woman in that era, at least in the Western world, simply had very restricted options. Mm-hmm. And for a young, beautiful, by all telling woman to say, I don't have to go home with you. And it was also at that age where apparently a romance was blossoming.
Well, I mean, people sort of move away from that term romance because there's still this overlay of the age difference. And
she was what, 16?
She was 16, and he's 46. And that, just think about that in terms of the difference in attitudes. I mean, if you could sort of imagine, you know, having a 16-year-old daughter and having her sent to live with a middle-aged man, you know, for years. I mean, people wouldn't do that because middle-aged unmarried man with no woman in the household, stuff happens. You can imagine things that would happen there.
But did they ask Elizabeth, her mother,
to let if she could go?
Yeah.
No, of course not. Of course not. I mean, she was at Eppington, which was Jefferson's sister-in-law's plantation, with Jefferson's younger daughters. And Elizabeth Hemings was still at Monticello, which is about 90 miles away. And the sense is that this was done a sort of a spur-of-the-moment decision to send Sally Hemings.
Let's come back with a great deal more about the entire family who lived at Monticello. And we're doing that with a very accomplished lawyer, teacher, and, dare I say, historian, Annette Gordon-Reed. The Hemingses of Monticello. We'll all be back in just a moment.